I suppose in some ways, like, this paper arises out of work that I've been doing for a while, but it's not about torture and trauma as such. So anyone who is afraid that they might get too much torture on a Friday afternoon, that's not the case. But it draws out some of those themes, and I suppose part of it is tentative work, where I'm kind of trying to work out how to think about affect in relation to literature, because I'm not sure that it's at all clear. And so I'm really interested in the discussion and what you guys have to say after the paper, because I do want to work this up into something substantive. So please. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country on which we meet, and pay respects to elders past and present. So very little action takes place in David Foster Wallace's short story, Forever Overhead. On his 13th birthday, a boy climbs the dive tower at a swimming pool in Tucson, Arizona, but freezes at the top. That's it. Yet the story maps the emergence of pubescent fragility in the entangling of body and world in a short yet complex stretch of dilated time. Its sentences fold the boy and his surrounds into one another. The water, quote, the water is spangled off soft blue, 5 o'clock warm, and this pool smell connects with a chemical haze inside you, an interior dimness that bends light to its own ends, softens the difference between what leaves off and what begins. Throughout, the writing attends closely to performances of self. You are in line. Look around. Look bored. And repeatedly, the world impinges on his body. The rungs hurt your feet. They are thin and let you know just how much you weigh. You have real weight on the ladder. The ground wants you back. Soon, the enormity of his ritual performance comes to occupy his very being in the world. Time, quote, thickens around you as your heart gets more and more beats out of every second, every movement in the pool below. Not yet able to step out onto the board, breaking the deliberate rhythm of the preceding divers, drawing the gaze of every pool goer, the boy is suspended, narratively and temporally. All the story's suspensions, suspended movement, suspended time, suspended bodily change, remain only on the verge of becoming something else. Forever Overhead accumulates an intense charge as it progresses, but Wallace refuses to release it. The body of the pubescent boy, the crowded bodies at the pool, the body of the text, and the reading body are each and together intensely affected, yet this intensity finds neither actuality or direction. All its virtual futures are suspended in potential. So when I first read this story a month or two ago, living room distilled into a pool of lamplight, glow of the gas fire, a little bit of scotch, I was caught in an unexpected way. I've been to Tucson and I know the Southwest, the mountains that form a spiked line, quote, an EKG of the dying day. Tucson figures prominently in my own fiction. A character of mine might have been this boy. And when I was young, I too had this ritual. I climbed the tower at Ride Pool and launched myself into space. I stomped on the board, flew, cracked through the hard blue surface, tasted the chlorine so deep my ears popped. Returning to the story with a critical eye, taking notes to write this paper, I found that intensity repeatedly interrupted, especially whenever I sought to ask how the text did what it did. Yet, even as its effective force on me dampened, I became more alive to the affect at work within the text. The contact between surfaces, the mingling of boy, chlorine, smell, ladder, the rhythms of movement and swollen time, the subtly differentiated repetitions, and the agency of objects. So how are texts, whether Wallace's story or any other, to be read for something so inchoate, so indeterminate as affect? By what means are affects within text to be traced, and how is this different from reading for emotion? Where in the text does affect reside? Is it in the bodies, or worlds, or objects, or in the intermingling of all three? And if affect is, as some theorists suggest, a signifying, how can it be figured within the signifying work of literature? Can affect stand as a critical tool on its own, or does it only form part of a toolbox? And if there is some value in the experience of the reader, how is that experience to be accounted for in rigorous critique? Permeating all of these questions, I think, is a larger one, which is what is the purpose of critique? In an oft-cited article asking whether critique has run out of steam, Bruno Latour calls for a shift in approach from chasing facticity to assembling new thought. So his target is critical projects founded on judgment, on determining quality and value, on investigating hidden meaning and adjudicating its relation to other texts or historical moments, on debunking false beliefs and exposing naivety, and so on. Such critique, for Latour, has reached a point of exhaustion. It has become part of the problem of the contemporary world. Literary studies is perhaps no exception. Rita Felsky opens her book, Uses of Literature, by pointing to the lapse of revolutionary thinking into dogma. Quote, "We know only too well the well-oiled machinery of ideology critique, the X-ray gaze of symptomatic reading, the smoothly rehearsed moves that add up to a hermeneutics of suspicion." Similarly, Marco Abel claims that, quote, "critical practice ends up in one form or another, laying claim to what critics believe to be a well-founded position of judgment. Such critical judgment does a kind of violence to works of literature because it establishes an insurmountable distance between critic and subject, one that is repeated in the distancing language of much academic analysis." Stephen Mukey, in an experimental essay titled Motorcycles, Snails, Latour, argues that what's required for criticism without judgment is writing that composes, that creates the new through an aliveness to its situation, to its histories, to its personal relations. Like Marco Abel and Stephen Mukey, part of what motivated me to write this paper was Michel Foucault's famous appeal for just such an approach to critique. Quote, "I can't help but dream about a kind of criticism that would try not to judge, but to bring an oeuvre, a book, a sentence, an idea to life." So more questions. Can affect be taken up to give criticism this kind of life? And what might this mean for the way we read? And what might doing so entail for the way we write critique? Post-structuralism and ideology criticism were probably the two dominant currents of literary theory over the last 30 years, and both indebted in different ways to psychoanalysis and its splitting of the subject. I'm being horrifically reductive and broad in these kinds of claims. And by ideology criticism, I mean like Marxist inflected criticism. Feminist and post-colonial theories, for instance, while vital politically and academically, often owed their epistemological ground to post-structuralism or to ideology critique. So neither of these two major currents gave much attention to the stream of affect running beneath their surfaces. Consider Roland Barthes in Pleasure of the Text. Of the impossibility of pinning down bliss, he writes, quote, "Neither culture nor its destruction is erotic. It is the seam between them, the fault, the flaw, which becomes so. Seams, cuts, grates, caresses, crackles, such words proliferate." In his book, pleasure emerges unexpectedly for Barthes in something within the text that acts upon the body. A text, quote, "produces in me the best pleasure if it manages to make itself heard indirectly, if, reading it, I am led to look up often, to listen to something else." I think he understood the affectivity of texts, even if he didn't name it such. Aphoristic, fragmented, and unfolding, Barthes' writing contains sensual movements. Just as the garment reveals flesh only to again conceal it, his writing plays in the relation between terms, in the space between body and text. He wanted, quote, "language lined with flesh, a text where we can hear the grain of the throat, the patina of consonants, the voluptuousness of vowels, a whole carnal stereophony, the articulation of the body, of the tongue, not that of meaning, of language." Yet if there is nothing outside the text, to borrow Derrida's referential mantra, the material body can only be deferred. There's always a gap, a difference of substance, an aporia. And I think we might call this affect. So within the school of ideology critique, affect has played a somewhat more explicit role. As Lauren Blant points out, ideology critique can be read as an account of the affective realism of everyday life, the various attachments and fantasies and nostalgias that come to constitute subjectivity under capitalism. Within literary theory, this manifests most famously in Frederick Jameson's The Political Unconscious. "History is what hurts," he writes. "It is what refuses desire and sets inexorable limits to individual as well as collective praxis." This capacity of history to hurt, argues Blant, arises from its shaping of the affective present. For Jameson, however, the heroic role of the critic is to emancipate the text from the unconscious ideological subjection of the author to unveil its hidden meanings. Affect might be the antimony of the narrative impulse in realist fiction, as he's recently argued, but it doesn't offer the capacities to for liberation. It marks a course shift from modernist care to postmodern flatness. Jameson is interested in repair, I suppose, rather than creation. This points to what The Effective Turn has sought to rectify, the absence of materiality and material bodies in accounts of politics and culture. So while The Linguistic Turn, with its constructivist epistemologies, drove a flourishing of theory, it eventually produced an emergent orthodoxy in critical practice that privileged fissures and gaps and seams that a sufficiently astute a critic could pry open to show inherently unstable plays of meaning. And, you know, around the same time, the collapse of communism as a practical project cast doubt on the tenets of ideology critique, even as its critical approach struggled to escape the postmodern flattening described by its leading proponents. So if, in crude terms, all was linguistic play or enactments of false consciousness, what was the productive purpose of critique at all? Hopefully we can argue about some of this stuff. These critical currents, however, were not homogeneous. Feminist and later queer theorists in particular had sought to bring the body to the fore and proved inspiring terrain for radical thinking. Gilles Deleuze, especially in his work with Félix Guattari, reconceptualized much post-structural thinking, doing away with fractures and absences in favor of spectrums, continuities, and relations. Renewed interest in the American psychologist Sylvan Tompkins via the writings of Eve Sedgwick and, of course, Anna, among others, approached similar questions of relation from a more biological perspective. While an emerging body of research in the neurosciences challenged the primacy of cognitivism, asserting a deeper, more constitutive, and more entangled role for affect and emotion in thought. Cultural studies rose to prominence, and its questions pushed theory towards materiality too. Trauma theory, with its origins in deconstruction and psychoanalysis, increasingly sought embodied ways of understanding ruptured experience. The Effective Turn can thus be understood as a turn to relationality and materiality, rather than difference and language, or even simply culture, which of course remain crucial, but no longer occupy center stage. So whereas Derrida, De Man, and other key thinkers of the linguistic turn had their roots in literature, theorists of affect are more disciplinarily diverse. In part, this is not surprising. Who hasn't felt the visceral force of the cinematic image, or lamented the slippage of contemporary politics into base energies, or been addicted to games on their mobile phone? Cinema, media, social and political theory, these and other fields pushed ahead of literature in asking how affect might work in the world, in cultural objects, and in our relation to them. Why that proved the case, and why literary studies continues to wrestle with how to deploy affect theory, has much to do with how affect itself is understood. So, in the simplest terms, affect refers to bodily capacities to act and be acted upon. Affect moves bodies, moving bodies are affected bodies. As such, it is that which occurs not in one thing or another, but in the relationship between them. In what I'd say is the dominant mode of thinking, which is derived from Spinoza via Deleuze, affect is, quote, a pre-personal intensity corresponding to the passage from one experiential state of the body to another and implying an augmentation or diminution in that body's capacity to act. So just to unpack this a little bit, I think there's three aspects that are crucial. The first is that affect is kind of pre-personal. It's not defined by its involvement in the intention or cognitive recognition of a given individual. Second, affect is relational. It occurs in the passage of bodily states and thus in the connection, engagement, and implication of bodies with one another and the world. And third, that it involves a change in the affected or affecting body's capacity to act, to be empowered. Thus, affect can be understood as a kind of intensity without structure. By contrast, feelings are named sensations that flow from affects, and emotions are the recognized accumulated histories of affects and feelings. So in this context, Brian Massumi's well-known formulation, the autonomy of affect, describes a forcefulness that is owned by neither one body nor another, but both constitutes and is constituted by those bodies. This intensity, crucially, is a-signifying. Lacking structure, it cannot contain any prior meaning nor a definitive intentionality. Sylvan Tompkins, though, rather than abstracting affects to this degree, conceives of them as involuntary bodily reactions to encounters with stimulus. As such, there's no predetermined relation between the stimulus and the affect it prompts. Affect obtains cognitive meaning only once it's registered or recognised. Only then it is an embodied response that shapes experience but lacks definitive semantic content. Only once the affect is recognised does it obtain meaning as such, and thus shifts into emotion, which is accumulated over time and scripted into the subject via memory and biography and so on. Tompkins differs in important ways from that Spinozan approach of Deleuze and Musumi. Chief among them is his insistence on discrete named affects like shame, joy, disgust and so on, suggesting that there is something closer to signification at work in his understanding of affect. In a controversial essay, Ruth Lees argues that, quote, both these approaches share a single belief, the belief that affect is independent of signification and meaning. She goes on to reject such theories of affect on the grounds that her reading of neuroscience does not confirm this precognitive quality. I take issue with Lees's approach in her critique. I don't think that contested and still much contested neuroscience invalidates either the Tompkins or the Musumi Deleuze approach to affect. But I do think that that her recognition of a shared resistance to signification is a useful one. Tompkins' named affects might be thought of as intensities on the verge of actualization, already at work on the body, but not yet signifying of anything definitive, pre-signifying maybe rather than a-signifying. Yet, for the purposes of my paper today, I'm going to treat these as much the same thing, and this may be something that we could discuss. Anna may have some different views on this, I don't know. Part of the argument for affect, it seems to me, is that it offers such powerful ways of describing non-linguistic forces, most evidently in fields such as art or cinema or video games. How it applies to literature is less obvious. Recognition across much of affect theory on this sort of a-signifying or pre-signifying quality makes it an uneasy fit with literary theory and literary studies, which are both justifiably concerned with practices and processes of meaning-making. Yet I want to argue that a-signification, or pre-signification for that matter, is not something outside the purview of literary studies. Rather, it offers potential in recalibrating how we think about literary works and the work of literary critics. So, in a widely read article, Sharon Marcus and Stephen Best offer surface reading as an alternative to the symptomatic readings of literary theory. Surface reading attends to, quote, what is evident, perceptible, apprehensible in texts, what is neither hidden nor hiding, what, in the geometrical sense, has length and breadth, but no thickness, and therefore covers no depth. A surface is what insists on being looked at, rather than what we must train ourselves to see through. Thus, the text presents the conditions of its own analysis. Theory's task is to emerge from the text and to adapt to its demands, rather than determine the text's meaning from an external, privileged position. Such a move does not, I want to emphasise, devalue theory, but rather values the textual object as a thing in itself, an object with agencies and intentions and potentials. Nor does this move to the surface allied absences or fissures, the cracks and seams that moved Roland Barthes to pleasure. Counter to the symptomatic approach, we could read gaps and absences as possessing a kind of forcefulness, an intensity of absence. Thus, the sentence that collapses in on itself or the enfolding of time that might be open to deconstructive interpretation can be read as doing something other than producing semantic content. Unlike deconstruction or other textual tools, affect introduces messy, experiential, and highly situated dimensions to reading. To read critically and effectively, the embodied self needs to be understood not solely in terms of its relations with the text, but its multitude of contingent and always changing relation to texts, media, spaces, knowledges, histories, geographies, and so on. So does affect reside on the surface? Well, yes and no. In some ways, affect speaks to the hidden and the concealed and the absent. We can be affected by what the text fails to speak of, and we can be affected by blank space. For instance, the form of a poem on the page can be affecting. It can do something. It can create a charge. As Marcus and Bess point out, there are materialities to textual surfaces, and surfaces themselves can be affecting. They are also zones of potential contact. They're where the action is. Surfaces are not flat, but rather textured and varied. Maps possess surfaces, but so too do territories. Simply looking at a surface will not yield up its complexities, its concentrations of detail, its shifts in topography. There is no need to mine the landscape to know its aesthetic force. Open-cut mines are monstrous in the natural world. They're monuments to blind technical prowess, and I think perhaps similarly so in literary critique. Surfaces can equally be found within texts, the surfaces of character, location, interiority, action, and so on. In the David Foster Wallace story I opened with, the ladder presses into the boy's feet, and his subjectivity melds into the moment, merges with the variegated surfaces of other bodies, of the pool, of the hot sun, the distant mountains. Reworking surfaces and convening new sites of contact enables and is enabled through affect. The story's intensity arises in the convergence of surfaces. This is what loads the extended moment of bodily and embodied contemplation atop the dive tower. My contention then is that surface reading needs to extend to the affective contact between surfaces within the text. To read for affect as it functions within the text is to take seriously its internal betweenness, the internal betweenness of the text. Rather than insist that a text must unveil something hidden, affect enables us to see how literary works rely on both signification and its falling short on the forcefulness of asignification. So the key to widening the scope and application of affect to literature might lie in identifying the form of contact between surfaces. Masumi argues that affect is unstructured in intensity, but it is useful to consider whether affect might in fact animate particular structures of relation, which we might think of as forms of contact between surfaces. Rita Felsky's uses of literature, recognition, enchantment, knowledge, shock, can be thought of in this way. So each of these particular forms of contact with the literary have an affective dimension. So here is her account of recognition. Quote, "Suddenly and without warning, a flash of connection leaps across the gap between text and reader. An affinity or attunement is brought to light. With enchantment, there is, quote, no longer a sharp line between self and text, but a confused and inchoate intermingling. In producing knowledge, quote, language gestures ceaselessly beyond itself, while shock, quote, tells us something specific about, tells us less about the specific content of an affective state than about the qualitative impact of a text or object on the psyche. So while affect itself might be unstructured, it does not always occur divorced from structures of relation. And I think perhaps there's an affinity here with Tompkins' notion of particular discrete affects like shame and joy and so on. Within literary criticism, then, affect provides a way of thinking the intensities that enable particular kinds of relations to instantiate, endure, and enable various forms of becoming, both within texts and relation, and in relation to wider milieus. So emerging from the ideology strand of critical theory, Lauren Ballant's work on cruel optimism connects affect within texts and in their encounter with social and political milieu. So cruel optimism, she says, is a particular structure of relation, an affective experience in which something desired simultaneously blocks one's path to fulfillment or flourishing. Describing its operation in John Ashbery, Susan Sontag, William Gibson, Colson Whitehead, and others, Ballant shows how texts elucidate the cruel optimism of neoliberal capitalism. Crucially, however, her interest is not in its representation or revelation as such, but rather its work as a specific quality of the affective present, the wider affective present. Texts depict relations of cruel optimism, but they also both reproduce and resist them. In other words, literary works can be vehicles for evoking and critiquing social, political, and cultural affects, and not only in generalized forms like critiques of fear. engaging in the affective calls for a methodology of critical suspension, I think. Criticism, as Marco Abell argues, does a kind of violence when it rushes to judgment. This is not simply the violence of judgment itself, but also a quelling or dampening of part of what makes works of art powerful, which I think is their affective intensity. His thesis is that suspending judgment opens up a space for entering an event or text on its own terms. Crucially, this is a suspension in time, so that meaning is not immediately subordinated to already known positions. So thus, rather than encountering Wallace's description of wet dreams at the beginning of Forever Overhead and then predetermining the meaning of the young boy's narrative, a suspension of judgment allows what follows its own messy, indeterminate, and effective rumblings. This is essential to criticism, allowing affect its a-signifying intensity, its autonomy, but without giving up on the project of criticism more broadly. Deconstruction used textual paradox to expose semantic fragmentations, and ideology critique revealed the contradictory, unrecognized presence of false consciousness. Affect enables a generative view. Gaps, absences, and so on speak to what remains unformed in language, but not without meaning or potential meaning. Not meaning exactly, but the intensity of encounter with something other that precedes meaning. Here is the boy stepping onto the dive tower, and the heat, and the queries of the man behind him, the dark smudges on the board. And here are all the words that came before, and my histories of the Wright Aquatic Centre, and so there is a loaded moment, one of many within this short narrative. Just as events in life could spark movement in multiple directions, turn many virtualities into distinct actualities. So this brings into the text the indeterminate intensity of becoming. So casting its shadow over this account of literature and affect is the reading body. In different ways, phenomenology and reception theory in particular have sought to theorise readily subjectivity in relation to the text. So Wolfgang Iser's proposition that the actions involved in reading should be of equal importance to the text provided one system for understanding readily response. And his ideas prefigure some of what affect brings to the table, an emphasis on the virtuality of texts and their coming into meaning in the act of reading and so on. And so too Merleau-Ponty's work on embodied perception. Yet scepticism toward the very validity of bodily experience is far more pervasive in literary criticism than recognition of its value. In the influential 1949 essay, The Affective Fallacy, Winsett and Beardsley argue that certain critics confuse the poem and its results, which means that the poem itself, as an object of specifically critical judgment, tends to disappear. Writing in the last century, in the middle of the last century, and without either the insight or burden of French theory, they call for closer attention to the text, for objective reading. While I take issue with their calls for both objectivity and judgment, they are right to demand the critic give heed to the object status of the text itself. As Judith Butler and others have shown, language is not at all a disembodied thing. So too the text. Not only is it performative, it has the capacity to injure. Denise Riley notes that while there is a forcible affect of language which courses like blood through its speakers, language is nonetheless impersonal. Its working through and across is indifferent to us, yet in the same blow it constitutes the fibre of the personal. So too the text. It can grip and rework the body, yet nothing within it guarantees its effects. Affective criticism suggests that the reading body be neither privileged nor elided, but recognised as coextensive with the critical act. In no small part, the problem of the reading body is a problem of writing. So to return to Foucault's critique, call for a new form of criticism. Quote, I can't help but dream about a kind of criticism that would try not to judge, but to bring anew of a book a sentence, an idea to life. It would light fires, watch the grass grow, listen to the wind and catch the sea foam in the breeze and scatter it. It would multiply not judgments, but signs of existence. It would summon them, drag them from their sleep. Perhaps it would invent them sometimes, all the better. Criticism that hands down sentences sends me to sleep. I'd like a criticism of scintillating leaps of the imagination. It would not be sovereign or dressed in red. It would bear the lightning of possible storms. It's a powerful call to arms and a tall order to fulfil, perhaps too tall. Yet it speaks to a generosity of spirit and a fire of belief that can be all too lacking in certain critical practices, literary or otherwise. Foucault's dreamed for criticism is not self-congratulatory or idealizing, nor is it lacking in rigor in the desire to overthrow convention. Quite the reverse. Like Deleuze and Guattari, Foucault asks that critical practice be expansive, generative, and productive, that it challenge through leaps of imaginative insight, that it be the harbinger of change. It cannot do this if its focus is overdetermining meaning and rendering judgment. Once affect enters the critical frame, generative criticism becomes essential. Criticism that works to eradicate literary intensities does violence to the text. But what in practical terms does it mean for criticism to catch the sea foam in the breeze and scatter it? Far easier to set a challenge than to meet it, and there is a risk too that placing so much emphasis on critical writing might elide the literary work in an even more radical sense than can occur in post-structural or ideology critique. One answer might lie in the ficto-critical tradition. Another might be in creative work itself, which I'm sure we all agree can be a kind of critical practice. Maybe we don't all agree. Rather than prescribe a particular form, however, I would prefer to explore what the dynamics of such critical writing might be and how that might be brought into relation with affect. Criticism, then, needs to compose rather than dissect. For Latour, quote, "The critic is not the one who debunks, but the one who assembles, the one for whom, if something is constructed, then it means it is fragile and thus in great need of care and caution." He proposes a constructive compositionist ethos, one driven by an ethics of care. The object-oriented ontology proposed by Latour and others gives objects, bricks, desks, waves, music, halogen globes, an ontological status independent of their social construction or relation to the human. This means that objects are always only partially knowable, but not because their meaning is always deferred into difference in that post-structural sense, but rather objects are withdrawn because they do not give up all their properties to perception. So taking this up into literature, it might be important to be willing to grant the literary work a kind of generative agency within the act of criticism. Thinking of criticism as co-composed with the textual object, as not residing apart from it, but webbed within the field of its objectness, might seed the ground for literary criticism that seeks new ways of encountering the surfaces of texts. In his essay responding to these critiques of critique by Foucault and Latour, Mucky asks how writing can account for the ecological, with its endless engagements between non-human actants. He proposes an experimental writing that is, quote, "actively engaged in creating assemblages or compositions as it goes along." Mucky wants writing that, quote, "necessarily participates in worlds rather than a writing constituted as a report on realities, seen from the other side of an illusory gap of representation." What he calls object-oriented writing aims to show objects as animated, not simply operated on by external causations. Fictional beings, Mucky notes, are not simply referential but reproductive. Their fictional status does not make them lesser. It signals a different mode of existence. Critical writing must become a writing with, he says, rather than a writing about. Following Latour, Mucky reserves some scepticism for the tendency in critical theory to claim recourse to a beyond the subject and object, which he considers simply a third term that lacks actual substance. And there's a risk here, I think, in relation to affect, that it becomes something so abstracted, so in between, that it simply repeats this move into an other beyond, which is, again, inaccessible. Affect could become merely a new form of deconstructive referentiality, one conveniently lacking in reference. That is why it's crucial to retain its embodied and visceral quality, I think. If we are to take seriously this call for an approach to criticism that composes the new, we need to be willing to become entangled in the complex web of relations engendered by an open engagement with affectivity and with texts. Or to turn this on its head, to learn how to write of the affectivity of a text might well enable us to write criticism that does something more generative and productive than diagnose symptoms. writing with a literary work means writing in a state of effective attunement. Yet critique cannot be reduced to a kind of sustained sympathy. It must attend to the multiple forms attunement can take, including its loss or absence. It must also be alive to durational shifts in intensity. It cannot treat the literary object as divorced from time, either in its objectness or in the experience of reading it. Now I too am overhead, perhaps, diving board, stretching into the blue, dark stain of feet pressed onto its furthest point, traces of skin on the roughened fiberglass. Custom dictates that now I will stride forward, leap into the air, and propel my heels into those same patches. Then, as Wallace writes, tilting the tense into the future, the board will nod and you will go, and the eyes of skin can cross blind into a cloud-blotched sky, punctured light emptying behind sharp stone that is forever. At such a height, slipped fleetingly free of Earth's surly bonds, the critical project might feel itself on the cusp of something new. Here, then, are four propositions for the work of affect in criticism beyond judgment. I say beyond rather than without, because I want to retain the spatial and temporal presence of judgment, and because I believe criticism needs to move rather than excise. So, four propositions. First, the suspension of judgment opens space for affect to affect. Judgment here is not simply about valuation. Does the work work or not succeed or not? Does it succeed or not? But of determinations of meaning and purpose. What the text means need not be decoded in a rush, but given room to breathe. In the first paragraph, Wallace tells the reader, quote, "Your 13th is the chance for people to recognise that important things are happening to you." This is a beginning, but it need not tell us how to read or predetermine the accumulated moments of the text. The story narrates a self-devised ritual, a public performance, but it also brings to life countless contours of the pubescent body in its worldly emergence. There's the promise of freedom and the constraints of the real, of the weight of becoming new, of being folded into an effective machine of expectation and motion, these bodies lining up to climb the tower, creaking on the rungs ahead, the pressure to leap. Suspending judgment is a first step in letting these small encounters breathe. It enables the critic to occupy a space between the purely personal account of the text and the universalising of an aesthetic experience, a threshold maintained by evocation of context as well as closeness to the text. In short, suspending judgment means allowing intensity without signification to circulate. Second, we should attend to the surfaces of texts, not simply as surfaces of obvious meaning, but as complex, refracting, unfolding, and variable textures. Surfaces are not only seen, but felt. They are what the act of reading encounters. "Forget your towel," writes Wallace. "Stopping for the towel means talking, and talking means thinking. You have decided being scared is mostly caused by thinking. Go right by, toward the tank at the end. The pool's concrete deck is rough and hot against your bleached feet. Each of your footprints is thinner and fainter. Each shrinks behind you on the hot stone and disappears." Surfaces touching surfaces, leaving traces to fade. Each contact is visceral, yet also marks the tentative quality of a body moving through the world. Most marks aren't permanent, yet their very fading is a kind of passage. Note the solidity of the hot concrete. Note the caution against overthinking. But not all surfaces are so distinct. Texts possess paradoxes and absences, and these too can have their force. Perhaps the boy's suspension on the dive tower, forever overhead, is not a fracturing or breaking off of narrative, but an amplification of intensity. All this accumulated forcefulness, all this bodily tension, all this potential allowed simply to become. Perhaps this points to what Felsky calls a use of literature, something we might name liberation. We need to seek out and elucidate further structures of relation to and between the surfaces of literary works, as well as their social and political milieu. So third, affect constitutes both passage and process. It enacts across both time and space. So texts do not simply produce stagnant signifiers of asignifying forces, but rather embody the processual durational quality of affectivity. So as the boy climbs the tower, time dilates, and each micro-encounter with the world magnifies in scope and force. Listen, it does not seem good the way she disappears into a time that passes before she sounds, like a stone down a well. But you think she did not think so. She was part of a rhythm that excludes thinking, and now you have made yourself part of it too. Affect and cognition are intention within the boy, but affect is at work textually too, the force of its intensification in the time she hangs in the air. Then there's the paradox of still time in narrative, yet the passing time of reading. Quote, no time is passing outside you at all. It is amazing. The late ballet below is slow motion, the overbroad movements of mimes in blue jelly. If you wanted to, you could really stay here forever, vibrating inside so fast you float motionless in time like a bee over something sweet. Yet vibrations that still time are illusory, just as moments of textual stasis are too. Affect is at work, a variable intensity, a betweenness that is also a passage. Fourth, critique should be generative. It should compose and assemble new thought, yet feel no compulsion to complete or enclose. In this paper, I've tried to write with David Foster Wallace, yet only attended to a small patch of his story's surface. More might be said, much more, yet the text need never lose its agency, its independent objecthood. Our ambition should be critical writing that enacts intensity rather than simply asserting or describing it, critical writing that resonates with literary text rather than dissecting its operation. Empiricism in composition, in short, such that theory is not laid over the text, but rather emerges from within it and the situation of its reading. In turn, methodologies for reading and articulating of affect need to be generative, not reductive. There might well be epistemological dilemmas in heedlessly bringing together affect and object-oriented ontology, as I've just done, but I'm more inclined to pursue what the glow of their friction illuminates than obsess over their reconciliation, or at least not today. Neither hero nor supplicant, the critic beyond judgment might find a space alongside the text, suspended overhead perhaps, and alive to an increasingly felt, fleetingly held intensity. But nothing stays suspended forever. Cleaving the water shatters its smoothness, yet the surface returns to relative calm soon enough. The trick is to keep diving, to keep the surface disturbed. Reading literature and writing criticism in the wake of the effective turn will surely prove to be a messy business, all the better. Affect might be asignifying, but it is not without politics. It enacts movement, sparks change, brings the body into tune with the wider world. If literary studies is to meet the new challenges it faces, institutionally and in practice, it must be willing to engage new theoretical currents and new fields of knowledge. Suspending critical judgment, seeking its beyond, might return to the literary text its agency, its capacity to move, and with it the possibility of criticism that bears the lightning of possible storms. Thanks.